glad you said that. I'm writing a chapter in a book on that topic, project management. And I agree. It's where the mess is. You know, don't get caught. And, you know, it's not covered, I still believe, often and often at the conferences on eDiscovery. But, Monica, we talked about the Phoenix 4 case today. And today there's another very high-profile case involving Qualcomm, where 14 attorneys from a mid-size IP boutique firm are being asked to defend themselves for their potential role in ESI not coming forward during the case. Briefs are due later this week. There will be a hearing in October. We didn't cover this case on purpose because it's still ongoing. But now for the leading question, given that backdrop, do you think eDiscovery can be really dangerous for a law firm?
Well, the Phoenix 4 case is certainly Exhibit A for that. The thing that I come back to on this over and over again is that in the paper world, in the old-fashioned world, it was the client's case, and the lawyer was the mouthpiece, the advocate for the client, with duties of candor to the court and duties of candor to the bar. But the duties, the expectations that courts are imposing on lawyers are, in my mind, unprecedented. And I think there are a lot of lawyers out there who aren't aware of this sort of sea change that's occurring. And I don't even know if the judges who are writing about it are aware that they're really changing the role of a lawyer from advocate to auditor. And it puts law firms in a terribly difficult situation when everyone talks about having IT people to go in and check what the client's doing. I have to believe that most of the clients of most of the lawyers on this call wouldn't take very kindly to a law firm insisting on barging into the premises and doing an audit of their work. Now, there's a diplomatic way to handle that, talking about it being for the client's own perspective, but I think you have to combine that with an unfortunate rise in suspicion and cynicism among companies that law firms are just in it for the money, that law firms are just trying to pump up their bills, and that there's a lot of overkill going on among law firms with respect to e-discovery projects. And so it's led to a lack of trust in some cases where a lawyer says to a client, we need to do X, Y, and Z, and what we outside lawyers don't know may be going on in the inside is the people on the inside aren't even necessarily sure whether they can trust us when we say that those things have to be done. So it's one thing for the judges to impose these obligations on lawyers, but lawyers can't force these things to happen. And so my advice for law firms is to be proactive, to ask the right questions. Frankly, you hate to be documenting yourself all the time, but to do it at least by email and make recommendations by email so that if firm is ever put in a position of being potentially adverse to the client, whether due to a sanctions issue or otherwise, at least you've got a record that you were proactive, and as one of the speakers earlier mentioned, you know, that you sort of have a checklist, that you've reflected your due diligence. But ultimately, it's the client's case and the client's exposure, and the client is going to make cost-benefit decisions about how it wants to handle discovery, and the lawyers aren't in a position to overrule that.
This is a question I'm thrilled we have the panel for. I have a lot of friends who are large, really mega firms that practice in this area with fairly substantial departments and resources. David and also Tom, Monica, if you want to chime in, do you have any advice to middle market law firms for how to be successful practicing in this field? And it's even smaller firms than the firms that you're at. I have friends that are at 30 attorney, 40, 50 attorney firms that are, you know, don't have the resources around them, but they have to be technology very savvy. And you know, I just believe that this more and more litigation is going to have these issues. 75% of all these cases, of all, electronic discovery issues come from the mid-market cases. So what advice do you have?
Well, as a starting point, I mean, I think you have to get into e-discovery and records management to some degree if you're going to do litigation today. And I think there's two choices, either do it right or in virtually every case you're going to have to associate with co-counsel who does, because you can't litigate without e-discovery today. But, you know, that being said, there are two different areas, I think, for success. First is the knowledge and competence. And second is the business end and the marketing. for the knowledge and competence, you have to devote the effort to have your education, your attorneys and support personnel become knowledgeable in e-discovery and recognize what you can and can't do and when you have to, you know, turn outside for help. You have to have access to technical consultants who are qualified, know who to go to for what, because oftentimes time is going to be the essence and you can't start, you know, looking for the consultants when the problems come up. When you do it, you have to do it right, what we've been talking about, having a process with follow-up and documentation. So, I mean, that's the you know, knowledge and competence area. I mean, as far as marketing, you have to let your clients and prospective clients know that you have these capabilities. You have to work with them and hopefully get them, you know, attuned to litigation readiness before it comes. They may think you're just out trying to, you know, make money by giving them unnecessary services, but if you can get them to at least make a start, when, you know, when they get to the litigation or investigation, they're going to thank you for it. So, I mean, to me, the key to success is developing the skill and knowledge and staying up to date with it.
I agree with what's just been said. In terms of being able to handle these issues economically, which is certainly a concern for, well, everyone, but particularly for middle market to smaller size companies and firms. I just wanted to say a few words kind of about the care and feeding of vendors and when they need to be used and when they perhaps don't need to be used. Our firm has a license with Summation, which is a program that allows you to view documents. It's an electronic database. And there's a threshold where if it's a relatively small document production, such as probably fewer than about 75,000 pages, we generally load the electronic data on Summation and review them there without incurring the expense of using an outside vendor. But generally, when we expect there'll be a larger amount of documents and data involved, we'll go to an outside vendor to process and host the data on an online review application, and there are generally going to be additional costs to the client associated with that, including hosting charges, but we found that they're generally justified because it allows you to look at every document in the case in a single database, and you aren't dealing with the database slowing down, which happens in Summation as you approach that that threshold. So I just wanted to let everybody know there's a helpful guide to vendor shopping at the Sedona Conference website, which is www.thesedonaconference.org, and it's often difficult to figure out who's giving you the better deal because these vendors often have very different pricing approaches. And it's a challenge to be able to compare apples to apples, but I would recommend looking at that that white paper for a sense of how to do that. But you really need to talk to these vendors, ask them a lot of questions, get them to show you their product, and don't buy more product than you need for your case. Different cases have different needs, and you really need to be savvy in dealing with these vendors. In a kind of a larger sized firm, we found it helpful to keep a vendor database where we include comments about vendors we've used, just so people who are considering hiring a new vendor can take a look at that and either you know, hire somebody we liked or not hire somebody we hadn't liked in the past. And one final tip, I don't know if anyone else has done this or not, but I've had cases where I've used different vendors from our opposing counsel, and I've also had cases where opposing counsel and my client have shared the same database. And we've found that in the case where we've shared the same vendor, rather, it's led to a lot of cost savings, the vendor, I think, gave us a better deal than if we the different parties had used different databases. It eliminated the problems in having vendors communicate with each other who really have different protocols and speak different languages. In the case I'm working on now, there's a lot of translation from vendor A speak to vendor B speak, and a lot of time and money, I think, is wasted on that, and I think that would have been avoided if we had been able to use a single vendor. So that's something that's worked for me. I don't know if anyone has had a different experience, but I think that that's a good cost-saving approach.
Monica, I don't know if you have anything else to add.
No, I think David and Tom's comments are right on.
Great. Carol, survey after survey, and the ones that I've noticed are at AIIM, which talks about a lot of record management issues, but they show that middle market companies are more comfortable with their records management systems than very large companies. That initially surprised me. Why do you think that's so?
I think it's because, first of all, mid-market companies are small enough to get their arms around the problem. I think they have, when they do get behind an initiative, they can truly get behind it. One of my friends, who's the records manager of one of the largest privately owned companies in the world, said, "Carol, there are 90 companies I have to do this for worldwide." So there's really an order of magnitude difference. I think another reason is that a lot of mid-market companies, when they grow by acquisition, they actually acquire the company. They don't just set it next door to themselves. So they actually integrate them. And what that means is that not just the company and people have been acquired, but the processes get reworked, information gets reworked, and you tend not to see as many workarounds as in a very large company. So it's not uncommon. On the other side, though, they are the first to say, you know, here is a specific problem that we need to resolve, and then they go out and they resolve it. So that's not to say that they don't have problems, but just that they have an easier time addressing them.
Tom, from a litigation perspective, does having a better control of your records at a middle market company give you an advantage with handling electronic discovery over, say, a larger company?
It's hard to answer that question in the abstract. There are certainly some middle market companies that are very savvy about and comfortable with handling electronically stored information, and there are others, I'm sure, that aren't. But I guess as a general matter, it's not surprising that middle market companies seem to have this comfort with their data, because presumably they have less of it than larger companies. It's challenging, I think, at any level, and I'm really reluctant to draw lines at large or middle or small. It's something that just needs to be done the right way, no matter what size you are.
Jim, as a Six Sigma expert, I know you don't like to have a clean slate because you like to go through process and look at defects, like measure things from past performance, but let's say you have a clean slate here to handle e-discovery projects, and let's say that middle market companies might, in general, have a cleaner slate to handle these projects. What creative solutions might you consider to design a better process in this area for middle market company?
Carl, I'm going to zero in on a specific part of that question, which was design better processes, because I think of solutions a lot of times being technology, and I think that technology solutions are the control that's used as far as a better process. I want to comment on one thing, because every time I hear the word vendor, I cringe. Now, granted, I was in-house for a long time, and now I'm on the other side. But one thing, I'm going to make a distinction. We made this at DuPont, and Tom Gilson knows this, because Lewis and Roke is a part of the network at DuPont. We make a distinction between what we call primary law firms and also primary service providers. And I think that's an important thing because I think there are a lot of vendors. I think that's a very derogatory term. I just think of a lot of people are kind of like going door to door and selling. And I think what's important is
no offense intended.
What's that?
No offense intended.
No offense intended whatsoever. I think what's important, though, because I want to make the distinction, Tom, because I think it's important, is that a service provider often is someone who's brought in almost like as a strategic partner and brings in a certain expertise. And I think in the area of discovery management, maybe where the law firms do not have as much expertise, and they obviously are needed for the legal advice, and they hold that defensibility piece of this and a huge responsibility, but I think process management and process controls is something which can be found more in service providers than they can be in law firms. And one thing I'm going to do a little plug here. An article that Tom Sager, DuPont, and I just recently wrote, and it's basically titled Plaintiff Thinking, and it's going to be coming out in the ACC docket in January. And it's really interesting because a lot of times in this whole discovery area, law firms will very much fall back onto kind of like a defensive posturing. And there is some risk, no question about it, as we've kind of unveiled here. But I think this is true for mid-market as well as for the mega market. And a lot of times it's kind of like to, you know, it almost comes out as like keep everything, review, analyze everything, and then go ahead and potentially produce what we find as a result of that. And I think that companies, be it mid-size and large-size, none of them can go ahead and digest that. That's a lot of cost involved in doing all that. And I think that what really comes into is process design and going with that clean slate is design a couple different things. One term of art that we've used at ACT is called intelligent document triage. And it goes through a process by which you can identify where the areas of risk are and levels of treatment that should be taken as far as preservation, filtering, and also review and production. And I think to go through that process with the business buy-in, they can go ahead and make decisions relative to, you know what, we don't need to keep everything. We don't need to review and analyze everything. And we'll talk later, I think there's another question, about what tools might be out there that allow for you to maybe take some risk and maybe rely on some automation to help speed that process along. But it's also in the interest of the client to go ahead and to reduce the cost. So what I guess I'm trying to say here, Carl, is my clean slate says bring in process management expertise. One of the processes I should have mentioned, by the way, is data mapping, which I think is very important as far as the electronic landscape of a company is to kind of map out where those areas of potential evidentiary materials lie and also where the areas may be of risk in terms of trying to do preservation. But one, as I say, is to get process management expertise, do a mapping out process, and number three is to go ahead and run that process out and really go ahead and figure out how much it would cost for each of the individual steps and also what risk is associated with each of those steps and allow the client to make some decisions and let them go ahead and sign off on that in terms of risk and cost and also for defensibility.
Kevin, with your new company, MetaJury, you provide a service to audit a company's electronic discovery process and charge only a percentage of the cost savings achieved. So from that approach of trying to figure out where cost savings can be achieved, do you have any advice to a middle market company on how to deal with these projects and save money? Is it okay to cut corners? Presuming they'll maybe cut more corners than a Fortune 500 company anyway because of budget concerns, where can you work to be more efficient in this area is, I guess, where I'm trying to get at.
Well, I think following up on some of the things that David had said earlier about the difficulties of having multiple vendors and, you know, vendor speak, over the years, language has been a very important part of my personal toolbox. In years gone by, when I was doing a lot of litigation internationally, the strength was being able to speak French or German or whatever else. And then later on, when we were doing discovery work, it turned out that the ability to speak both legalese and geek speak were important as well. A lot of what we do is just bridging those gaps between the business people, the lawyers, and the technologists to try to make sure that there aren't a lot of assumptions that are out there, to make sure that the work that's being done by vendor A is compatible with what vendor B is doing, a lot of what, you know, David mentioned earlier. There's a number of things that you can do in order to try to make sure that You're getting consistent process and consistent documentation. And consistency is the thing that's going to really drive your cost savings. Is it okay to cut corners? I guess the answer to that has got to be it might be. But that's really a risk management question. I remember when I was first started riding motorcycles, there was a great sign over the top of a display that had expensive motorcycle helmets, and it said, if you have a cheap head, settle for a cheap helmet. So I guess the question then is, what is your level of risk that you're willing to settle for? Cutting corners is dangerous in practically any profession. Companies should never attempt to cut corners without determining what the legal risk is through consultation with their legal advisors. A lot of times you'll have people who are very well-meaning, especially in the IT field, who will feel, oh, well, these backup tapes have the exact same data as the backup tapes in that box, so if we've got 27 boxes, we'll only keep 13 of them because it's all the same data. Well, that doesn't help you when you're asked in either a meet and confer or when you're having a discovery conference with a judge, and he says, well, what happened to all of the boxes of your backup tapes? That's not going to put you in good stead with those people. The best way to save money is to take your lessons learned and try to move your internal systems to a point where it's easier to collect, process, and collect the data. You know, we heard some discussion earlier from the panel about the fact that records management tools and records management processes, if those are put in place, whether it's during your standard operation or if it's put in place at the time that you acquire or divest a piece of business, doing that from the very start will save you a lot more money than anyone coming in at the tail end of the process trying to advise you as to what to do with electronic discovery. Rather than trying to feed the e-discovery beast on the back end of the process, it's better to push the document creation and storage processes within your organization. They're going to eliminate or at least mitigate a lot of these issues from the start, so that once the point comes where you're entering into litigation or you're entering into discovery, you've got your ducks in a row and you've already got a lot of those things taken care of. Trying to push it further into your organization and plan for the future is what's really going to get you the biggest bang for your buck.
Carol, I think I heard a cheer from the three or four ARMA locations that are on the call. Came through. I don't know if you heard it too, but anyway.
Sure.
Tom, from a lawyer's perspective, what role can task-based budgets play in the e-discovery world, and how do you handle the economic reality that your client in the middle market just doesn't have the budget to spend on an e-discovery case like the mega market companies sometimes do?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the kind of the proper management of, I won't call them vendors, but vendors, that's something that can play a big part in controlling a budget, because their costs can really skyrocket. I wanted to add something to the question you just asked about cutting corners, and it's something that's certainly tempting from a client's perspective, and maybe others have had this conversation too. Why can't we just have our IT people collect our data? Why do we need to have it collected forensically? And there may be some cases where that might be appropriate. I wouldn't say it's never appropriate, but I know that it has happened, and it probably will continue to happen, that companies will attempt to do something on the cheap now, and they'll go in and somehow alter all the metadata of the documents there, or the data they're collecting, and that's something that you've really got to be careful about. And as the last speaker said, you really have to carefully balance the risks involved and the potential expense that you might need to incur down the line when having to fix a problem caused by cutting corners early on. I just wanted to make one other point, which I don't think has really been stressed, is that one of the main themes of the new e-discovery rules is the need to address all of these issues involving the storage and maintenance of electronic data very, very early on in the process. And that's something that obviously needs to be included in the budget, but the message of the new Rule 26, to me at least, is that if you're going to wait, if you're going to sit around and wait for a complaint to drop on your desk, that is really going to be too late to start learning about such issues as what's our company's retention policy, what's our policy about keeping and recycling backup tapes, what type of portable media are employees using, where is our data located, what servers are being used, what data is on PCs, because the litigants now need to meet and confer about those very issues very early on in the process. Again, this is something that's too important to try and kind of cram in at the last minute. And I just wanted to mention also that it's becoming, I think, more and more prevalent for I just think generally some of the larger companies. Maybe this wouldn't be applicable to the people listening to this group, but some of the larger companies are hiring what's been called coordinating e-discovery counsel. And these are outside counsel that make it their job to understand what the company's where the company's data is stored and how it's being treated. And they actually attend the meet and confer sessions and the Rule 16 conferences to make sure that there's uniformity in the way local counsel is explaining what the data systems are like, what their limitations are. And I think that's a pretty good practice if you're a large enough company to have that warranted.
Actually, you raise an interesting point, and I'll throw it out there just before I ask this question to Jim. But I went in to a mid-market company locally here in Pittsburgh with a good friend of mine in Cleveland who's an e-discovery expert, and he was talking about the process this company was using with going through their records and the tool that they had found, which was an inexpensive tool to sort collected data. And at the end of the meeting, my friend Tim said, you know, they just changed all the metadata in their case. And, you know, it was interesting. So Jim, you know, there's a lot of choices out there. How do you find technology to use in the project if you haven't done this before?
Sure. Carl, let me add one thing before I answer that question, and just follow up on what Tom just said. In addition to this emergence of discovery counsel that can be found at outside counsel, there's also been the emergence of discovery managers or someone who has a discovery manager role within corporations. Again, that's probably more with the mega companies and with the middle market, but that's also been an evolution. But one thing I just wanted to point out, as we're talking about the role of outside counsel too, and cutting corners, I just want to comment on that. Let's put cutting corners to the side, but I think there's some healthy records management and compliance policy decisions that can be made by a company, and what they're looking for and what I often look for when I was at DuPont was outside counsel that would validate and sign off on them, either policy or process improvement. And I think that's a huge role that the mid-market firms can do, is to say it's okay to do this. So oftentimes either they don't have a policy or they're looking to make a policy change. It could have something to do with no longer maintaining backup tapes for a certain amount of time period, or instant messaging policies, whatever like that. And for an outside counsel to sign off and to back that and support that policy decision change is a huge value that I think any firm, but especially the mid-sized firms, could offer. Now, as far as your question on the technology, I think right now, as far as the marketplace, there's not a whole lot of scalability. And this is unfortunate with the mid-market. A lot of these solutions that are out there, which go what I call upstream, so before discovery management process starts going into vogue, you really have some things that can be done upstream in the Carol's area, in particular around records management and the areas of ESI and just how things are stored, how things are archived, et cetera. And tools, and some of them have fallen more into these like our archiving solutions, they're still pretty expensive propositions. So what I have found is that the technology is probably a little bit cost prohibitive. Now, having said that, a lot of times the mid-sized markets don't need these huge, big rocket science tools, and they may be able to do something within kind of like some of their applications already just to do some basic retrieval of data and maybe also ways to go ahead and to implement some form of records retention. So those things do exist, but in general, they're not ones that are kind of like built for that. It's more for accessibility and for some kind of application to help with some kind of business process. So I guess my bottom line is right now, the technology, for the most part, I think is more geared for the large market companies, and mainly because they're kind of really cross-prohibitive with smaller, but there are some what I call hidden gems without naming anything that can be found that really more address, I think, the mid-market and give you some of the basic retrievability, potentially some things that can help you identify materials that need to be preserved and also for retention purposes.
You know, Carol, there's a component of this question that I think you probably have something to add. Jim had talked about how expensive the archival systems are that are out there, and middle-market companies might not go down that path. So what would you suggest?
Well, I think we're actually coming to a point in information technology where we're starting to understand that the current technology, the IBMs and FileNets, the Hummingbirds and Documentums, the Stellants, et cetera, they're architected for a department, not for an enterprise. And so it doesn't matter how much money you have, you can't buy the product. If you want it to be compliant to a standard, for example, DoD 5015 or the European one, MOREC, they're on MOREC 2, your product can't be larger than a departmental solution. And I think one of the things that a number of entities are starting to rethink, for example, NARA has partnered with OMG, the Object Management Group, to create a standard that would focus on what we're doing instead of the product. So in other words, you would focus on, well, what do you actually want to do with this? Well, most organizations don't really care for most of the functionality on DoD 5015, which is a government standard, but a lot of companies have adopted it. And I think one of the things we're finding is that good records management practice is independent of technology. And the technology can either help you or it'll hurt you. It might make some things a little bit easier. It might make it a lot harder. One of the complaints I have when I go into a lot of different companies, large, mid-size, and small, is as soon as that product can file as well as a person with a high school degree, I'll be very happy. But most of the products out there actually get in the way of good records management, and that is because they were designed to manage only creation and distribution, not the rest of the life cycle. So they go out there and willy-nilly create and distribute with, you know, very bad results, paying no attention to family planning and contraception and all those good things. Here we have all these you know, document babies all over the place that we now have to do something with. So I think the solutions are out there, but you have to look at your records architecture from the perspective of people and how they behave in real life, not how software companies think they should behave in terms of the technology, what is it possible to do, and then in terms of organizing the information in a way that is appropriate for your company to manage retention, security, output management, privacy, and many, many other things.
Carol, this is Jim. I just want a question about this as well, or a comment. Aren't you finding that a lot of these solutions require a lot of feeding and care too, and
oh my God,
as far as not just a owner, but it can be a group of owners within a company, and this is obviously an issue with mid-sized companies for resources.
Oh yeah,
but these systems really do require a lot of feeding and care.
But it's variable. One of the things that we found is that some products just require a whole lot of overhead and some do not. Mm-hmm. And the ones that do not have less functionality, but one of the things we find in software development is that quite often less functionality is actually better than more functionality.
Boy, I'd love to say something, but it might get me in trouble, so I'm not. I'm going to go about my own experiences with software. But anyway, Monica, as outside counsel, how do you work with a middle market company when compared to a larger company? Is there a difference in strategy?
You know, personally, for me, I don't have any difference in strategy. The only possible impact on me would be whether I'm dealing with an in-house lawyer as my point person versus a non-lawyer. And some middle market companies are pretty thinly staffed in the law department, if any, and so you end up working with business people. So you might need to provide more explanation of what the reason that you're asking certain questions. But I go through the same checklist every time when I'm hired to work with a company or repeat business from the same company, and that is to start by asking whether there's a litigation hold in place and asking about what investigation has been done, what's been determined with respect to who the key players are likely to be, what the universe of relevant information is likely to be. And if there is a litigation hold in place, we certainly go back and revisit that periodically. I think that many of my middle market clients are more sophisticated in terms of responding to electronic discovery than some large companies. It depends on the type of business that they're in, the type of attention that management is willing to give to legal litigation issues and e-discovery issues. So I don't think we can assume that middle market companies are all less able to deal with electronic discovery issues. What it takes is management being aware of the importance of the issue and assigning staff. I completely agree with someone who said earlier that having an in-house person assigned on the technology side to deal with e-discovery requests is terrific, and big companies sometimes have a whole department. But I think that I ask all of the same questions. I basically interview the people that I'm working with and try to drill down to the efforts that have been made. But I don't think there's a real difference in approach. You have the same cost-benefit analysis you do with large companies that you do with middle-market companies as well. You know, I think it's important to note that there's a perception that large companies can afford to spend whatever it takes, and large companies are often the most resistant to that. They have the most nailed down budgets and sometimes the most resistance to spending a lot of money on a particular issue. So I don't think it's one size fits all, but I also don't think there's a specific dividing line between a strategy with a middle market company and a large company.
Okay. David, most middle market companies don't, at least as of a couple of years ago or last year when I was talking to some mid-sized law firms about this, they really didn't want to think much about e-discovery. And is the time to really learn about this area the time when you've been hit with litigation?
Well, from what we've been discussing so far in this conference call, the answer is obviously no. Kevin talked a little bit about this, but to elaborate on it, you know, it's best to have a comprehensive records management program for both paper and electronically stored information, which includes an e-discovery readiness plan or action plan, you know, with a point person and assigned responsibilities and things of that nature. You know, the more advanced it is, you know, the better off you are. And I think that's basically it. We've talked about these things enough, but, you know, it is not the time to do it when the litigation's there. You know, be prepared and be as prepared in advance as possible is the only way to get a handle on it.
Kevin, you know, at the conferences I've gone to recently, you keep hearing the cost for storing and processing information has been dropping substantially. Is the good news that these projects have become more reasonably priced or commoditized, or is there no good news in here?
Well, I guess there's a couple issues here. First of all, I think I'd take exception to the idea that discovery is commoditized. Sure, you've got some common tools and processes that are being used, but you can't apply the same sets of tools and processes to every case in a cookie-cutter fashion. You can't even do that within the same organization or, you know, the same defendant. You've got to make sure you have this listing of people, processes, technology. It's got to be a good mix. It's going to take care of all of these things. You're going to reuse as much as possible, but I think we're a long way from commoditization. At this point, the lower cost of storage is being offset by the increased cost of having to process and review all that additional data. One of the racks that was in the airport that I saw the other day as I was passing through had a PC magazine on there. And on that magazine cover was a single desktop machine that had 4 terabytes of storage on it. Now, I can tell you that I've got several terabytes of data as well between my home office and my regular office. And I think that's got to be a wake-up call for people that just because the amount of storage is becoming cheaper and cheaper, you've also got to look at, well, yeah, it's great to store all this stuff, but then I've got to process it, and I've got to deduplicate it, and I've got to look through it, and I've got to have people review it. I've got to do redactions in some cases. So there's a lot of other things that are going on. It's a great example of how you can't focus on any one variable and just come up with a snap decision as to manage these things every single time. You need to get an overall view of both the client and the specific case, and then use commodity services where possible and specialized services where necessary in order to make sure that you're taking care of all the data. So I think that the only thing that the cheapening storage does is assist the budgets of IT groups that are trying to manage their spend and trying to do some cost avoidance. They're going to be able to store more data in less time on less storage, and that might make their lives easier, but as attorneys, it doesn't do anything for ours.
Okay, I got a question from the audience, and we're at the point where we can take questions from the audience. And it actually refers back to the case that we didn't read the facts for, and I'm not going to read them, but it's a good case to read, and the facts are in there. But Tom, in the Faber case, claim damages were only $2.5 million, and the judge did not think the anticipated cost of doing a search would exceed damages. Do you agree? And if anyone else wants to chime in on that, because I know others deal a lot with the searches from the IT side as well. Hello, Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry, I had you on hold. Could you repeat that question, please?
Okay. In the Faber case, claim damages were only $2.5 million, and the judge did not think the anticipated cost of doing a search would exceed damages. Do you agree? By the way, this question came in specifically for you. So if you're dealing with opposing counsel on this type of an issue, I don't know, maybe.
Is the question talking about, well,
whether
I guess you don't know what it is, but
the damages are only $2.5 million in the Faber case?
Yeah.
And the judge didn't think that the search for additional information would exceed damages.
Well, I think that's something that, you know, courts, they consider kind of proportionality in all these cases. And I think that, you know, it doesn't surprise me that there's no kind of single answer as to, you know, if the cost of searching is X dollars, then it's you know, necessarily too much or too little. And I mean, that doesn't really surprise me that the court looked to the amount of damages sought when making the ruling about the amount of time that was required to look in, you know, to do the searching.
Yeah, and I mean, to follow up on that, the judge wasn't making a ruling based on that observation, except that he was asking to get estimates to determine what it was going to cost, and
right,
was going to make a decision after estimates were obtained. So, you know, so that was an observation that was kind of dicta in terms of where he ended up. I have sometimes, however, found that when you ask for estimates on searches, particularly of backup tapes, all you'll get is order of magnitude type predictions. And, you know, they say that until they start at least sampling the actual backup tapes, they can't give you anything, you know, more specific.
Yeah, those backup tapes are really a hornet's nest to deal with for those of you who haven't had to deal with them in the past. And it's really very complicated and confusing, particularly when the tapes aren't labeled. And just one aside on this point, I think it's generally a good idea to use backup tapes for the purpose for which they were intended, disaster recovery. And because the courts are generally going to look at, when deciding if the backup tapes are reasonably accessible or not, they're going to take a look at whether or not you were actually accessing them for some reason. So, you know, I'd think twice about starting to, you know, use backup tapes to actually recover data and during the course of your regular business operation, because if you do that, then you're going to run the risk of the judge coming back and saying, reasonably accessible, you guys are using those tapes in your regular course of business. So that's just something to think about.
Carl?
Oh, go ahead.
No, Carl, I'm sorry, it's Jim. I just want to pick up on one thing that Tom was just talking about. We have had some success recently working with a provider that does what I call a quick peek of backup tapes. And as much as there's the reasonably, you know, as far as accessible, there's also the thing about litigation readiness. And there are a number of, and this is mega clients as well as the midsize, that have this issue about just keeping the backup type tapes forever. And they're just kind of like sitting grenades sometimes on a beach. And what we have found is that if you have the ability, without having to do a full restoration and indexing of the backup tapes, you can do a quick peek to make some basic decisions about retention, and that can be a good thing, and there can be a cost-benefit analysis of doing that. So one thing I'll just tell you that there are some of the providers that are out there that are now offering some solutions that allow for you to do more a quick peek, and that can also be supported by some sampling to make some decisions if there is relevance or responsiveness, or if there's retention value in those tapes that they need to be kept, or can you go ahead and destroy those within your records management guidelines.
Monica, I did want to ask a question in the Peskov free Faber case. In that case, Faber's IT expert said they stopped searching further due to a lack of resources. Is this the sort of argument which judges like to hear?
Well, you know, it depends on whether it's an omnipotent federal judge or, you know, or but no, seriously, I think that if I recall right, the reference to the lack of resources was the fact that the IT person hadn't checked the Slack space of Peskov's computer. And that, for people who don't know what that phrase means, in layman's terms, is the empty space on a computer's hard drive that's going to contain temporary files or files that have been deleted. They can either be whole files or fragments of files. And those are things that an ordinary user can't see. You need certain to be able to see those. And that particular IT expert did not search for those. I think that there's a sort of a rule of reasonableness, and it. I think in the Peskov case, the court was frustrated with the parties generally, and I think a lot of these bad outcome cases, you feel the frustration of the judge where the parties aren't doing what the judge wants them to do, the parties aren't getting along, and so I think it's perfectly acceptable under some circumstances for a party to come in and say, no, I have not searched the Slack space. The question is, would it have been reasonable to consider doing so under the circumstances? And so I think truly that it's just going to come down to what type of information are you looking for? Do you have reason to think that there would be unique, relevant information in the Slack space of a computer that would justify don't have the in-house capability to do it, having an outside person make an image for you and restore that information so that it can be looked at?
And actually, again, I would suggest people to glance at this opinion. Judge Fasciolo is one of the more respected judges in this field, and this is a really good opinion, or interesting opinion. He lays out a lot of detail on what parties can do. Jim, in this case, which as Monica said was very highly contentious, electronically stored information searching and preservation case. It started in early 2004. Now it's in mid 2007, and they're still attempting to resolve how to find the electronically stored information. Is this type of case mooted now by the new federal rules and the meet and confer requirement at the beginning of a case?
I don't think so, Carl. And that's interesting. I'm trying to think of the best way to answer that question. I don't think it's mooted. I think that it is more on the stage, if anything. And as much as there is now the attempt at the meet and confer to go ahead and to bring to the table what is considered, again, what is not reasonably accessible and what is accessible, and also to identify maybe costs associated, have the ability potentially for doing cost shifting and the like, it's not that the issue is mooted by that. I think, as I say, it's just brought earlier, and it's just brought on the table, and it's probably just given a little bit more attention, but it's not mooted.
Kevin, just a general question.
Could I just jump in for a quick second? This is Tom. I think that realistically the meet and confer obligations, they're a great idea, and I think it's there's certainly value to requiring the parties to address these privilege issues, including clawback agreements and form of production issues and their network architecture at the beginning of the case. But to be honest, these cases are so complicated, and the storage of electronic information is so complicated that the parties, they're going to be surprises in the case. It's not all going to be worked out in the first 60 days of the case. There are going to be ongoing issues. There are going to be questions about whether certain data is accessible or inaccessible. And as a general rule, the parties that are kind of symmetrical in their size and the amount of data they have, it's going to be more likely that they're going to be able to work those things out. But I just wanted to mention that in a case that I'm working on now, we've recognized the complexity of these issues, and we've not only scheduled one meet and confer, we have meet and confers about every 6 weeks in this case, where we get together with all parties, all counsel, and we go over issues that have arisen in the case. And I'm certain that that type of thing isn't appropriate in every case, but in this case, it's helped us be talking to each other and trying to work cooperatively to get some of these issues addressed, because frankly, this is also so difficult that parties really are being forced to sit in a room and cooperate and work things out. Otherwise, they're just going to be intractable issues, and the case will become about e-discovery and not about the underlying merits of the case.
Tom, let me ask you one question just in regards. I'm just curious. Do you see where the meet and confer, where you are representing a defendant, could be a strategic position? Kind of attempt, and the reason I just say that is that I found that a couple times what we were trying to do when I worked in-house and also with a couple of our clients is that if you can use the meet and confer to take certain things kind of like off the table, potentially risk or concerns of who has a responding party, that then you can get more to the true legal substantive issues. But I'm not trying to lead you as a witness, but have you found those in any way to be strategic?
Oh, I think so, and I think that the more educated you are, the better you are able to deal with some of these issues that come up. If you know about the way that backup tapes are being processed, and if you have a sense of which servers are being used and which are not, then there certainly is a strategic component to the meet and confers. But you know, as I said, there's just I think a lot of value in this type of case, which is a pretty big case, to just forcing the parties to get their heads together and try and work these things out. Which is not to say that we are able to work all these things out, but at least having something on the calendar where we're forced to get in a room with each other and try and hash these things out as they develop, because the issues do develop. They don't go away just because the parties have sat down and had their meet and confer, or that a Rule 16 scheduling order has been entered. They come up throughout the course of the case. It's been my experience.
Kevin, just generally, because I don't think we really hit on this hard enough, we were going to hit on this in this case, but what is generally your obligation to search for accessible data from the perspective of some of the middle market people that are listening in who may never have done this before?
Well, I mean, the obligation isn't any different from a middle market standpoint than a large market. The obligation is simply that if you have actively stored information within your organization, whether it is in paper form or if it's in electronic form, you are honor bound to go through that information and try to find any information that might be relevant to a claim or defense of the issues related in that case. So if you have information that's available, you've got to go through it. So, for example, just as you couldn't say, well, I've got 400 boxes of documents, and I only decided to go through 12 of them to see if there was anything out there. If you've got 12 systems that you use to run your business in terms of electronic information, you can't say, well, I only looked in the financial one because that's the one that's got all the money in it. You've got to look through your, you know, your personnel systems. You've got to look through your unstructured data, the Word documents and PowerPoints and things that people have. So, you know, you do have an obligation to find anything that might be relevant to that particular case. So that really behooves you to sit down, try to figure out who the key players are, find out who the key custodians are that you might need to go collect or might want to go interview, and then go through that information, not necessarily with a fine-tooth comb, but make sure that you go through that information so that you can be knowledgeable about what is there and also what isn't there. I always mentioned when I was in the corporate side that a lot of my job was to prove that I didn't have something. If someone asked me for all the email that showed that person X had done some wrongdoing, and I turned over all of that person's email, they said, well, where are the ones that show that he did something wrong? I said, well, they're not there. And then you begin the argument about, well, is this all of his email? Is this part of his email? Is this only the email off of the server and not the email off of the hard drive? That's where the completeness of the discussion starts coming through as far as what you need to provide to show that you've done your due diligence. But that's basically what you've got to do. You've got to go out there and make sure that you've taken a look through everything that you've got available. And the corollary to that, of course, is the fact that if you were instead going to say that you didn't look at some sources because you considered them to be inaccessible, as has been mentioned a couple times on the panel already, that's the kind of thing you've got to bring out at the meet and confer. You can't say that later on down the road. You've got to make sure that you establish those points right at the beginning.
Okay, we're right down near the end here, but we got a question from the group. I'm going to give this one to Monica. It's a three-part question. Regarding the use of outside IT vendors, I see three advantages. First, the cost passes directly through to the client, so there's no issue about law firms seeking excessive charges. Secondly, if a dispute arises regarding how the search was done, it is better to have relevant witnesses be from the vendor, not the client or the firm. And third, firm and client demonstrate good faith effort by use of IT expert for search of documents. Do you agree?
Well, I will say that I think law firms can still get caught in the middle when a vendor is used. Particularly where the law firm is involved in recommending the vendor. I think that the clients, although the clients get the bills directly, they still hold the law firms accountable for the scope of work and the cost of work that the vendors are doing. So on your first point, it to the extent you find yourself in the unfortunate position of a client not trusting your motivations, I think that could be helpful, though I'm not sure that completely eliminates the issue. I think I think there are certain vendors that overpromise and underperform, and law firms can end up being sort of on the line when a vendor stumbles, though certainly when an in-house person stumbles, it's just as bad for the client. I guess it just depends on the client, and it depends on the vendor, and it depends on the law firm. There are many instances where the use of a vendor can greatly expedite and smooth a situation and avoid the difficulty of telling your client's IT expert that IT person that or suggesting that they may not know what they're doing. So I can't answer that question in black and white, probably like all of us have said in response to most of your questions. But I think you need to just proceed with care and have the client be a partner in the decision-making process to make sure that you don't get blamed for something that's done by a company that's sort of outside of your control.
Okay. This is the last question I wanted to ask because I wanted to end up on this one. And this is to start with Carol and David, if you have anything to add. We haven't talked about record management for law firms. It's mostly been for companies in the middle market. But given the topic, I thought it would be useful to spend a minute or so talk about what works, what doesn't, and why it's such a complex area. Carol, do you have any thoughts on this?
Oh, yeah. That's one of my specialties. Law firm records management is complex because it's a moving target. What lawyers do and how they organize the information, first of all, is different from practice area to practice area. It is different from firm to firm. And I have some very dear friends who are legal records managers who write about this, but they feel that there is a right way and a wrong way to do it. My experience has been that depending upon what the firm does, how old it is, its relationship to its clients, et cetera, as well as it's the attorney's relationship to the administration, that there can be wide variation in how files are set up and what their life cycle should be. So, for example, a firm that sees itself as doing, say, general corporate work would be doing something different from one that does transactional work. A firm that sees itself as being the general counsel for the corporation, so they go one step further than the general corporate concept, really see themselves as being the record keepers for the company. So you're going to do something very different. And that means records retention is different. That means how long you keep things, what format you manage them in is different. And my personal belief is that you have to be very flexible and realistic about what you can do. But it is possible. And for some of us, it's actually very interesting and fun work.
Okay. Dave, I don't know if you had anything else to add on that.
Just two quick points that goes right along with what Carol just said. One is that it really has to go along with the way attorneys work and the way they keep their records and information in their practice. Because if you try to impose something, even in a mid-sized firm, that won't work with the way attorneys and the law firms do business on a day-to-day basis, it's probably going to fail. Second, there are a couple pretty good references. One's an ARMA book on records management for law firms. The second one's an ABA book that came out last year. And both of them are pretty good as far as the overall considerations and processes.
Okay. Well, that's it today. I want to thank everyone for tuning in this panel. I want to say two last quick things. First of all, I want to thank FTI Ringtail because they at an eDiscovery conference gave me one of these little pocket drives, and I left my outline at the office and luckily had a laptop in one of these little drives, and in 10 minutes, what could have been very stressful, the disaster was averted. And secondly, I just want to let you know you're going to get some, if you signed up for this, you're going to get some supplemental material emailed to you. There was an article that I wrote, which Monica Latin and Carol Chotsky helped me with on evaluating new technology like streaming video. But it's a really neat topic, from an eDiscovery and a litigation labor employment area, as well as the copy of Discovery of a Discovery Land, which Jim Mikewitz and Kevin Esposito helped me with. as well as some others, as well as the $1 million and $500,000 bill, which they both appear on, which is sort of humorous. So look out for that. Thanks, everyone, and I guess that's it.
Great. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you, Carl.